Manjika, and welcome to A Portrait of Us, an NGV podcast where Australia's art becomes an instigator for holding deeper conversations about life, culture, and the incredible diversity of this country. I'm Brooke Blurton, and in this podcast, I get to talk to some of Australia's most significant artists. Together, we'll delve into how art reflects, challenges, and enriches our perspectives, drawing us closer to one another through dialogue and discovery. Here, art isn't just observed. It's our meeting point, our bridge to connect. In each episode, I speak with artists who embody the experiences and stories that make up Australia today. This podcast is all about celebrating Australian art and its people in its many shapes and forms. In this episode, we're diving into the powerful intersection of women and colonisation. Joining me for this exploration are Nam-based artists Atonga Tem and Yuani Scarce, whose work challenges and redefines our understanding of these themes. We'll also hear from Sophie Gerard, NGV's curator of Australian and First Nations art, who will bring her invaluable perspective to the conversation. Together, we'll unravel the complexities of this topic and uncover the profound ways women have navigated, resisted, and reshaped histories of colonisation. Yuani was born in Woomera, South Australia, and belongs to the Kokatha and Nukunu peoples. Her practice explores the political nature and aesthetic qualities of glass and photography, and often references the ongoing effects of colonisation on Aboriginal people. In particular, her research has explored the impact of removal and relocation of Aboriginal people from their homelands and the forcible removal of Aboriginal children from their families. Family history is central to Yuani's work. Drawing on the strength of her ancestors, she offers herself as a conduit, sharing their significant stories from the past. Yuani's professional profile has risen exponentially, and in 2024, she opened a survey exhibition, The Light of Day, at the Art Gallery of Western Australia. Atong is an Ethiopian-born South Sudanese artist and writer. She works primarily with photography and video to explore migrant narratives, post-colonial practices in the African diaspora, and the exploration of identity through portraiture. Atong explores history and mythology through a critical and sentimental lens. Atong has exhibited her work across Australia and internationally, including at the National Portrait Gallery, the National Gallery of Victoria, Tate Modern, Photo Ireland, and Photo London. So sitting here today with me is Yuani and Atong and your baby.
Yes, we've got a special guest, Isagani, with us today. He's one, so please forgive his boisterousness.
We're a VIP guest today. And we've also got Soph here today joining us.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here.
Before we begin this episode talking about women, colonisation, women artists in this country, I thought it would be nice to acknowledge a dear friend that we lost in Melbourne last week, the wonderful Destiny Deakin. Destiny was an Arab Torres Strait Islander woman and a fantastic artist. And she was a very close friend of the gallery. She worked closely with Yuani Scarce, who is one of our guests here today. And she was a guest on this podcast in Tony Armstrong's season that came out last year. So I just wanted to acknowledge Destiny on this episode today and keep her in our thoughts, I guess, in this conversation on women.
So starting off, you are both at incredible points in your practices. Yuani, your work held in a major exhibition in Perth in Noongar country.
Yeah.
Called The Light of Day, which I want to know more about. And then Atong, your work is held in collections right across Australia, and it was on display in last year's Melbourne Now at the NGV. Tell me, how does it feel at this point in your artist careers right now?
Oof, how does it feel to be here?
Here, now, how are you feeling today in this episode?
How are you feeling, Yuani?
I just walked Merry Creek, so I'm feeling pretty blissed out, I think, yeah.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I'll jump in because it's hard to not have strong feelings looking at my son, Isagani, who's here with us. and to think about as a woman artist in this country, there are a lot of hurdles that make it difficult to be a career artist, a practicing artist full time. And then that becomes even harder when you make the choice to become a parent. And then that becomes harder when you are, I guess, a full-time artist who's a parent that still wants to contribute, I suppose, like contribute not just to the art world, but contribute to the place I live in and the community that I live in. It feels kind of bizarre is, I think, the only word I can think of. What about you?
Yeah, it's interesting because when you were talking about being a mother and a woman artist as well, so I went to art school as a mature age student in Adelaide. I was 28, but I was already co-parenting two nieces with my mum and my baby sister who so I have three sisters and one brother. And it was interesting that you do often hear that women who want to be artists, who are artists, are told, well, I guess in my time frame of graduating, you don't have children because it sort of takes it, the child takes it away from your practice anyway. But, you know, there's like, we can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. And people said to me recently, it was like, you've raised two girls who were like 25 and 26 this year, one just turned 26. And it's like they were toddlers running around art school in Adelaide. And
I think, find that frustrating, I think, listening and feeling like you can't be a mother and have a career at the same time or a carer for other dependents and have a very successful career at the time. That's a frustrating thing about being a woman, I think, as well.
I think so. And I think it's sort of like we're good at multitasking. Mm. And it's like we're good at raising a family. And also within, you know, like Aboriginal communities as well, it becomes part of that network and it becomes part of family. So you do share that responsibility. And at that time too, before I left full-time work to go to art school, I was the primary caregiver in terms of money and probably still are with them girls, I think. Yeah, so it's kind of, it's interesting that it's just assumed that we have to give up, you know, goes back to the 1950s where you become a, you know, like you're supposed to be in the house and look after the husband and the kids. Yeah.
I think about that a lot because I do think despite, you know, the art career of it all and the kind of independent art, whatever, all that stuff, aside from that, it just is hard to be a parent now because so many of the structures, not just in this country but in a lot of the Western world, a lot of the modern world are dependent on this idea that, you know, the family structure is a nuclear family where, you know, the father works full-time and has very little to do with the children and the mother stays at home and has everything to do with the children and has no life outside of it. It's a very specific structure that is kind of impossible now. Like people kind of, for the most part, have to, you know, both parents, if there's two parents, have to work. People want to have their own identities outside of being a parent and all of that. But we don't have a lot of emphasis, I guess, on the extended family to make that a reality. Mm-hmm. Like I would be completely fine. I would have no issues whatsoever if I had a whole community with me and I could have my sleep and, you know, my art career and do fun things and have the baby. I feel like we're stuck between this 1950s idea of how to parent with this like contemporary ideal of wanting to be an individual and a parent and being able to do it all. But the structures socially just haven't caught up. Like we're not there, which makes it not easy.
No, yeah.
Can I ask a question? Both of you have used the term woman artists. And this is something that I'm interested in as a curator because we still do talk about women artists. We talk about them through in a historical context. And even today there's major contemporary art exhibitions dedicated to women artists. And I just wanted to know how you feel about that. For me, this sort of categorization is important, but it can also be tricky and problematic at times. You know, I think that we've come to this point in feminism where we still want to talk about the woman experience, and obviously the trans woman experience is even more complicated and worthy of discussion as well. But at the same time, I think that we are in this point of history where we've sort of been forced to assimilate in a way with men and the patriarchy. And So categorizing into this sort of women artist subsection can sometimes feel a little bit, I don't know, derogatory or something, pejorative perhaps. Mm. How do you feel about this title?
Well, when you were just speaking before, I was thinking about how the NAVA had released a statement in terms of like three female artists were, you know, had major solo shows, which I was named. Mm. And it's kind of like, but for me, it's about, you know, making a statement, but it's sort of like, why isn't women having solo shows all the time?
Is this in the Countess report?
In the Countess report. And it's like, but I think, but that it was kind of like after that, I think something where they were, had released further information and it was like, and then they said, but by the way, there were three solo shows. And it's kind of, it's interesting making those statements. I think it's kind of, we have to keep pushing all the time to make that happen. Mm. Why do we have to keep doing that when it is a given for other solo artists or solo shows? Or it's a complicated one, I think.
Yeah. I agree. But I think it's really important to talk about, and I think it's important to talk about it beyond the optics and beyond the, you know, we can look back and say that we ticked this many boxes of representation or whatever. That's hard. I think representation is such a tricky, tricky thing because it can be the foundation that institutions, whatever, kind of sit on. Like we represented, but then it's like what's happening behind the scenes, whose stories we're telling.
Yeah.
And when it comes to women artists, female artists, I think historically, post kind of feminist revolution, there was so much eventually we kind of built up over time an emphasis on including women in the arts, celebrating the women that exist in the arts, that have always existed in the arts. But often that lens forgot the diversity within the identity of woman. So there was a lot of white, female, able-bodied, straight, whatever artists. And even now, the idea of what it means to be a woman who's allowed to take that title, like all of the semantics of it, and the idea of this category of woman, the issue isn't the category, in my opinion anyway. It's forgetting that the category is an umbrella and there's so much within woman that is also, you know, that isn't equally celebrated. Not all women are equally celebrated. Not all women have equal access, you know. And I think it's really exciting when we interrogate why are we acknowledging these women in a particular way as an antithesis to the fact that men have been represented. Who are these women? What do they represent within the scope of what it means to be a woman? What are they saying? You're right. It is complicated because we're complicated.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And it's a complicated world.
Yeah, I wouldn't want it any other way.
Well, I know, yeah. Be too boring, I think. Yeah.
And also just to acknowledge as well that Destiny Deacon was the first black woman to have a solo ground floor exhibition at NGV Australia a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. An amazing legacy for her.
Yeah.
In this episode.
Quick side note question. A conversation that my girlfriends and I have regularly about white feminism, black feminism, and the difference between both. And I remember watching this speech about Tilla Reid. She's an amazing lawyer and she writes essays and articles around reckoning rather than reconciliation. And I love that about her. And she said white feminism is women breaking down doors or something like that, and then black feminism is women getting off the dirt floor. And it was like this really powerful quote. But it just hit me so much about the difference between white feminism and black feminism, and the difference between, like, I know it's very nuanced and very complex, but I just think, oh, like, black feminism is about sisterhood and womanhood and, like...
Yeah, and surviving.
Exactly. We all played a role, but I've never really felt like I've ever connected with the word feminism. Mm. Womanhood, yes. Sisterhood, titterhood is what we would call it. But, yeah, not feminism.
Same. Like, I haven't always felt feminism includes me, even though on paper. And I think a big part of it is, like, when the suffragettes were fighting for the right to vote, they were fighting for the right for white women to vote, you know. A lot of feminist movements, which did progress us, which did allow things that benefited us eventually, the idea was I want to, like, the white women wanting to be like white men. I want to be a slave owner too. I want to be able to vote, you know, as opposed to women in general, including the women that I would be subjugating. We all need to, you know, come up. And I suppose it makes sense because when we think about progression, if we all progress at the same pace, but we all start at different points on the road, some of us are going to be ahead of the others, which is why I think womanhood and womanism, which is a African-American term, I would love to remember who came up with it, but I can't, but an African-American quote-unquote feminist, and the whole movement was about, I suppose, intersectionality, which is also another term invented by an African-American woman, and the idea of you cannot speak to an issue, a cause, whatever, without acknowledging the complexities within said thing. So it's not just when we talk about feminism, for example, it's not just about we are women, what's hard for a woman. Because when you say that, you're standardizing it. So you're saying you're essentially making it your womanhood or whatever. I have to, if I'm fighting for women, I have to fight for trans women. Mm-hmm. Even though I'm not a trans woman, I have to fight for disabled women, even if I'm not disabled. You know, I've got to fight for women who never want to have children, even though I'm a mother, and so on and so forth. Like, it's like, it doesn't count if you're doing it to benefit just yourself and your circumstances. That's not feminism, any ism. That's individualism.
Yeah.
Which is an ism. Yes, I hear that. Mm-hmm. That's individualism, and that's patriarchal.
It's very, yeah. You know?
So, like, do we, who does it serve when we imitate our oppressors to try to better ourselves?
Mm. Yeah.
Not answering your question, but I thought that your point was important.
Yeah. Great. And just as you were talking too, it's like I was thinking about the aunties in South Australia that have been working for, you know, and some of them are deceased. I can't name their names, but it's like there was a proposed nuclear waste dump that has been... It's not shelved, it's still ongoing. It's just they're just trying to find a site. But there's been some really powerful ladies from Cooper Pedy Way, Anya Mutner Way, to even from my mom, you know, Marnie Sue Coleman Hasseldine. And it's kind of they've all stuck together. Mm. And it's like that's just the way it goes. Yeah. And it's like they're the ones that are again, going talking about sisterhood is kind of, and then it's, you know, us younger ones that are, you know, listening and following them too. Mm. So you always go as groups, and that fight is still happening, even though some of those ladies have passed away now. So it's kind of, I think there's power in being together, and it's, and then, you know, not separating.
Yeah,
I think.
Would you say, sorry? Just in response to what Brooke was asking about how we got here, would you say that that's what's contributed to where you are now?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I grew up in Alice Springs for 10 years and Mum worked a lot with some of the Walpree aunties. And I was like, I left there when I was 19 to go back to Adelaide because I'd had enough. I think I'd been to boarding school here in Melbourne. Anyway, won't go there. But always being around women, I think, also. And strong black women, and no matter whether they were blood related to me or not, it's just the way community happens. And then I think it took me moved back to Adelaide, thought I'd go to uni, that didn't work out, got a job, worked for a number of years and then decided I wanted to go to art school. And primarily I think because I was really bored with my job and... I was working at the Wilder Yerlo Support Centre, which is part of University of Adelaide, and it was for supporting mob going through uni. And I remember starting my job when those students started, and then I was there for 3 years, and then they were walking out with their gowns on, and I was like, well, what am I doing here?
Wow.
Like, and it's... And I went to art school with no expectations except for just wanting to be learn something and learn something that I loved, and then graduated. I think political work is always in my family. And I think back now after this survey show in, you know, the Art Gallery of Western Australia, it's kind of thinking about where did I start and where am I now? And it's like, met so many amazing people along the way. Hello. And like I'm still learning, I think. Like I may have what some most artists would say has achieved, and I have achieved a lot, I think, and, you know, when you think about my childhood and stuff too. I don't know. I still feel like I'm living the dream, really. If you told me that, you know, like I'd be exhibiting, you know, internationally when I've graduated in 2004, I'd be like, yeah, whatever, you know.
And Ioane, has there been any sort of feelings of, I mean, I think that cultural responsibilities, this sort of carrying on of culture and tradition is something that women feel a lot, and particularly in mob communities. And I wonder if this has been something that you've felt throughout your practice of this responsibility to carry on culture and tradition.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know how we were talking earlier about, you know, my grandfather having, you know, being one of 12, a lot of them were girls. And and I think of, well, they're my nanas. They're we lost our last one earlier this year. And I always say I come from a long line of strong women. There's a lot of women in my family. And I think I want my nieces, my girls, to have that too. And I think as an artist, have that as well, because I, you know, was raised as an artist by Destiny Deacon, Judy Watson, Julie Goth, Brenda Croft,
the matriarchs of the industry. Australian, exactly.
Yeah, so it's like, and I feel very privileged to have them in my life. Yeah, and they're amazing women and they're amazing artists, and I just want to be just like them.
Yeah. I mean, it's so, a great group of women to aspire to be like. What about you, Atong, and your Sudanese heritage?
I mean, we have a very similar thing in terms of culturally the importance of certain kinds of groups, I suppose. It's interesting because I think in my slightly younger years, I spent a lot of energy and effort being angry at sort of the patriarchal nature of my culture and how subjugated I felt that women in my community were, because we had these really specific roles and we kind of, for the most part, stayed together in family environments, because the culture is kind of based on a way of life that's really agricultural and small. But over time, I've kind of had a shift in my thinking, not that I all of a sudden love the patriarchy, but more that maybe the things that I assigned to patriarchy were not always like that. Like perhaps, so for example, traditionally women would be the ones that built the huts. So they'd go and collect the reeds and build the huts. And they're like massive, like some of them are, you know, 3-4 stories almost in terms of the size. And women were the ones that, you know, cooked and looked after children and all that sort of stuff, did the domestic tasks and everything to do with like the house and the home. And in maybe the modern era, that feels really patriarchal and really kind of submissive and whatever. But from where we're from and in the context of where we're from, I think it's really important for people to have roles and responsibility within a structure, like a larger structure outside of themselves. So it's like somebody has to do this, somebody has to do that. And of course it makes sense that, you know, over time women are like, you look after the children because you have them and you feed them and whatever. And then that kind of expands. And also I think placing every cultural aspect under the umbrella of patriarchy and therefore needing to be destroyed meant that I wasn't able to appreciate the very powerful role that women in the community have. You know, being the ones that tell stories, the ones that keep the culture. Like, we have this tradition of when you get married or like have a significant day, the women in your family write you a song. And that song gets carried on for generations to the point that at weddings, we sing songs from our tribe that go back tens and tens and tens of generations. I suppose women culturally for us are the ones that keep culture alive. And raising children is fucking difficult. Like, I had this really specific idea of how I wanted the women in my life to be strong outside of the patriarchy and against it, which meant that I wasn't able to see the ways that they were already strong and how I was given that and gifted that. So despite them not doing things in a particular way, I was raised by strong women who imparted really amazing ideals into me that have impacted the way that I make my work. Yeah, I got distracted because I saw my baby.
No.
And I guess it is this sort of blurring of all of these binary responsibilities that you were discussing about from men and women that has led to this point in history where, yes, you know, we can do it all and we've got amazing choices and that's so wonderful for women, but at the same time it's the burden of invisible labor of, you know, family responsibilities that still so often falls on the woman in the family, in this sort of nuclear family. And what it leads to then is having to do it all in a way that when we have these conversations about these expectations on men and women in these gender binaries, I guess there were clear-cut expectations that, you know, we didn't have to go out and make the money and then also cook the dinners.
Totally. Yeah. And there's a clumsiness, I suppose, in unlearning and redefining, because it's not ancient history, you know. It's not, I mean, it feels as though when I was in school, the majority of my friends' mums were stay-at-home mums and the majority of my friends' dads worked and everybody had a home and they could afford, you know, it was, it's not ancient history. So, yeah, that blurring is still, I mean, we're still defining the edges.
We're
but
working
also,
it out.
Do we need edges?
Yeah, I think he's just found the microphone.
Yeah, he wants to say something.
And how do you feel?
I might just feed him.
Whip a boob out.
Him distracted. Come here, darling.
So he's got good grip.
He does. He's a strong, strong baby.
The next question I'd like to ask is, how do you each feel life is for women now in Australia today?
Ioane, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, I think, yeah, it's an interesting question.
It's a big one.
Yeah. I think, you know, we've come quite far, but probably not far enough for women, I think. We're still waiting for pay rises, equal pay. Again, it's kind of still going back to women in the arts. It's kind of we're still, you know, can be overlooked a lot. So I think, yeah, we're still very, it's still very much a patriarchal society here in Australia. So it's, yeah, and I think, I don't know, as women it's kind of, or for myself personally, it's always we've got to be one step ahead of those, you know, that sort of thought process, I think. So, which can be draining. And I think, yeah, I still think there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not just within the arts, it's everywhere. It's kind of, I think, yeah. I think, yeah, it's a really good question. I think it's, you know, yeah. I don't want to say it's tough being a woman because it's not. I feel very powerful, I think, but it's kind of, you know, but I feel like I've got a lot of support who are my female friends and they're my family because I, you know, I come from South Australia. I live in Melbourne, but it's like I'm back and forth, but not in South Australia as much as I'd like to. So I'm not around my family, but I've got a really strong group of friends who we're all in the same boat together. So we just support each other in that way. And we always have these conversations.
You said you felt powerful. And I love when women say that because my friends and I have conversations about power often. And, you know, this conversation is about colonization and women, and colonization, you know, was distribution of power. And when I think of power, I used to think of it as a negative word, and that if you were in power, you were aggressive and you were hurtful and harmful. But then, you know, I sort of reclaimed that back within myself. And I love hearing when women say powerful because it's like, well, you are totally and wholeheartedly entitled to that power, and you are empowered to take up space in industries. But it's this feeling, if I say that I'm powerful, do I believe that? And am I believing? You know what I mean? We have these conversations all the time about how men distribute their power, but then how women have this real subtleness of saying things that are powerful and how much they filter and I guess how much more people listen and take on board that subtleness.
I think I've heard the term soft but strong.
Mm. Yeah.
And I see a lot of power in that.
Yeah.
It's like you can have that softness and strength, but you can be powerful to make change because people, that's how, you know, for me, that's a true leader.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you don't have to be yelled at and screamed at and told that you're shit in order to make change. I think, like, it's growing up with soft and strong women, some that yell a lot too, you know, but it's kind of, that's just the way it is. But it's like the ones that are softly spoken, you listen and it's like I think, and my Auntie Sue talks about it a bit, like she all talks about her way of protesting. And because there's a new rocket range, which is on Gugutha country, that because the Woomera Prohibited Zone is overseen by Department of Defence, so this private company has come in. And she was telling me a couple of years ago that she's figured out that if she sits there quietly, they can't test the rockets. So for me, that's really powerful.
Yeah.
Mm.
This idea of soft power makes me think about motherhood. I mean, Atong, you're sitting here feeding your child, doing the work, having these big conversations. There's nothing more soft and powerful than that.
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm learning to become comfortable with the term motherhood as opposed to parenthood, because it feels there's just so much history attached to that word. And especially because I feel like my partner and I, my husband and I.
That face. There's a lot going on.
He's a sound artist now. I think I made a choice to have a baby. I made a choice to be pregnant. I made a choice, given many, many, many options in this kind of age that I live in. And I made a choice with someone that I love and trust and felt that I could have an actual partnership with when it came to parenting. So because it felt like this shared thing between the two of us, and because I suppose in a lot of ways, even though it's a mostly heteronormative relationship, there's a lot of we put in a lot of work to do things that felt natural to us as a couple and now as a family, that meant that his role is not very stereotypical, to the point that I've even, like, you know, I'm unaware of it a lot of the time, because it's things that are very, very basic. Like he goes to the park with the baby and all the parents are like, oh my goodness, well done. You're holding your
good
baby.
Dad.
Good job. Good dad, you know, like that's the very, very minuscule version of it. But even things like when when you have a baby, you get enrolled into the maternal child health system and they look after you and the baby and check on you over increments as the baby grows. And then they put you into a local, they call it a parents group, you know, so that you can meet other people in your area who have babies around the same age so that you can do the thing together. We showed up together, my partner and me with our baby, and we're like, we're here for the parents group. And they're like, oh, just the mum.
Oh.
And it was, you know, things like that. And I was like, I didn't even want to be here. He is more keen than me. So, yeah, to go back to the point of this is I really struggled initially with the idea of motherhood and embracing that term, because it felt so loaded in ways that I didn't feel comfortable with, and it felt so restrictive. And I think with a lot of labels that kind of define us, there is a point when you can either choose to let it go or embrace it and let it have a bigger definition outside of what you've known it. Just because I felt uncomfortable with the restrictions of motherhood as a term doesn't mean that that's what that is. You know, there's a lot of friends of mine who are non-binary or gender non-conforming embrace the term motherhood as well for themselves. And it's, you know, like, oh, well, if I'm okay with that, then I can also be.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird space to occupy. I mean, the strength doesn't come from within. It's kind of forced. Like, you know, if you want your child to be healthy, happy, there's a lot of things that you have to push through that are hard. But the softness is the same as well. Like, I'm learning softness and I'm learning strength in equal measure, because I don't have a choice, really.
It might not be something that we want to talk about at all, but I just wanted to bring it up, because when we're talking about this sort of soft power as well, I just wanted to touch on the power of numbers, I guess, and how women are just so wonderful at making communities. And this is, I mean, I was thinking about this when you were talking about this kind of parent group, mother group, which was an unfortunate moment for you at that point. But I don't know, I just think about women banding together, and it's so powerful, particularly in, you know, mob communities and with women. And motherhood brings about these new communities as well. I mean, I'm a mother of a two and a half year old, and we've been sleeping really badly. And this morning I woke up to two text messages from other mum friends saying, how was your sleep last night? And I just think, like, we're so good at being there for one another as women. And this is something that men, I think I still see that this is a struggle for a lot of men. And I don't know, is there anything that we want to talk about here? I mean, Ioane, do you see this in communities with women?
Yeah, I think, yeah, same thing. Even like, you know, we're talking about, you know, that dreaded term perimenopause. I think. And it's like we're talking about sleep. And it's like we've gone through puberty again, but in reverse. And I think it's that thing of looking out for each other and looking after each other, even just stressful times, even like, you know, traveling a lot and stuff. And it's like, I need to be growled a little bit by my sister and stuff for you know, I need to slow down. And I'm trying to slow down. When you hear about people like my friend and mentor, Destiny, passing away, I think I just want to live life to the fullest, because we still have a lot of stories to tell. And I need to make more time for family and my nieces and stuff, all the girls, my friends, my female friends in Adelaide who were around before I became an artist. It's kind of that thing of like, and we're all mob. There's this term of like care that comes up in the art world at the moment, but it's kind of like, but for me personally, it's care outside of my art world. It's looking after country, looking after ourselves, making sure that we're well enough as women to keep carrying on as well. We've got a lot of responsibilities.
Yeah, absolutely. In these conversations about women in the arts and all that sort of stuff, and just women in general and feminism and all that stuff, I think it's I've been thinking a lot about the role that people who aren't women play in advancing the cause or whatever, and in supporting without us having to abandon, you know, ship and kind of whatever. And I feel like the big thing is women no care, because women have historically not been able to trust other people to give us care. You know, women build communities and become so good at it out of necessity. I think that's the thing that maybe people who struggle to embrace or understand, like, feminist ideologies or whatever, don't understand. It's not saying that women care because we're inherently better at caring, or women are, you know, women will text you because we were born with a caring brain or whatever. I think it's because we grew up in a world that expected us to nurture but also abandoned us, so we had to look out for ourselves and each other. And I think a lot about how I can teach that in a really positive way to my son, so that it's not an expectation nor a gendered thing, that care, community, like all these amazing things that women have historically had to do, like how do we teach that to the broader community, so that we, because it's great. And I have so much, you know, genuinely quite a lot of hurt and pain thinking about the men in my community who lack support, who lack care, who lack, and who rely on the women in their lives in quite unhealthy ways because they don't have it amongst themselves. And it's like, okay, you know, what can I give my son? How can I contribute these things that I've learned, whether I learnt them because I wanted to or not? You know, as an example, it's like, you know, a lot of my art comes from really horrible experiences, but I've been able to make really great things out of those bad experiences. A lot of women have so much gendered trauma, but we've been able to create community as a response to that. That's not a skill that's gendered, you know?
Yeah, I think that that's a really interesting and important point that you've made there, Atong. And particularly I like hearing you speak about how caregiving may not necessarily be this ingrained biological quality that women hold, that this could be potentially something that society and people have held onto and used as a sort of excuse for many years. So,
you know, as you've said, that these communities of women haven't always come from places of equality and joy. But I think that it's still, you know, within these communities and social relationships and chosen families, kinships, where joy is still so often found. And I think that that's a really beautiful part of womanhood and our connections to one another.
And on that note, Ioane, Atong, Isagani, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for joining me on this episode. I would like to acknowledge that this conversation took place on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country. We pay our respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are listening, as well as the elders past, present and emerging. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.